Today we're in the studio for the breakthrough second album by an internationally known million-selling recording project whose namesake neither sings nor plays.
I don't care what you do. I want more to be like you. Oh, oh, oh.
There has been and will always be a problem as far as the public's concerned of, you know, in perceiving what my role is as an artist. The explanation that I tend to make, you know, when this confusion arises, is that it's a bit like being a film director. I mean, Steven Spielberg doesn't appear in his movies, but he is totally responsible for the way they turn out. And that's essentially what I do on my records. I control their input and their output and their final destiny in a way, without necessarily actually appearing on them. Hello, this is Alan Parsons in the studio for the making of iRobot.
Writing in the All Music Guide, I like what Stephen Thomas Erlewine says about the Alan Parsons Project's 1977 second album, iRobot, and I quote, "Alan Parsons delivered a detailed blueprint for his project on their 1975 debut, Tales of Mystery and Imagination, but it was on its 1977 follow-up, iRobot, that the outfit reached its true potential. There's a sense of mystery and drama that can be very absorbing if you're prepared to give yourself over to it. The tunes have plenty of hooks, but they change tempo and feel quickly, which is what makes iRobot an art rock album instead of a pop album. That sense of melody, when married to the artistic restlessness and geeky sensibility, makes for a unique, compelling album," concludes Erlewine about iRobot. "Sci-fi art rock never came any better than this," end quote. From 1968 through 1973, Alan Parsons was a staff engineer in London at EMI Recording Studios, that's what we call Abbey Road, working with the Hollies, the Shadows, even on the Beatles' White Album as one of his first sessions. But in 1973, every audiophile discovered his name as the engineer on the worldwide hit by Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon. Here's Alan Parsons with me in the studio.
Yes, contrary to popular belief, I did not get rich out of Dark Side of the Moon. I think suffice it to say that, you know, they were the kings of studio experimentalism. There's a good word. I was taught by them the strength in experimentalism, playing with sound, manipulating sound, combining different elements of sound together to create, you know, a composition. That was the lesson I learned from them, that you could actually compose by creating sounds. And quite a lot of their stuff, I think even they would admit, was not written as songs. It was written as sounds being assembled. And I think that's something I carried forward into my own career. You know, they were vastly more experienced in the studio than I was, although I had, you know, I had the correct technical upbringing, of having come up through the Abbey Road engineering apprenticeships system, so I knew the sort of nuts and bolts of recording, whereas they I think they had more experience with knowing what toying with sound could actually achieve in terms of improving the creative process.
I asked Alan Parsons to describe his role as a staff recording engineer at Abbey Road Studios prior to forming the Alan Parsons Project.
I was employed as, you know, an assistant engineer, and you did what you were told. You said, today you're working with Ken Hensley, tomorrow you're working with Joe Loss and his big band, the next day you're working with Pink Floyd. I mean, it was like, you know, you just did what you were told. I mean, I was grateful for that, because you got to experience a very wide range of musical styles, and you got to appreciate different forms of music, and to work with, you know, lots of talented people and lots of untalented people. You know, it was a good background getting ultimately into the production side of things. We'll be right back. I've always said that the Beatles were the first to actually use the recording studio as a musical instrument. And when they started doing that, that's when the role of the engineer started to come into its own. And the engineer that they were working with at the time, Jeff Emerick, you know, was making a valid contribution to the way the record turned out. Whereas, you know, engineers up to that time had just been the guys who put the mics out in the studio, and then they were very much just told what to do by the producer, and they got a good natural balance. That was their job, you know. They were known as balance engineers. That was my title when I started to do a recording at Abbey Road. I was a balance engineer, and that the balance engineer's job was to make the instruments well balanced. And then it became a much more creative process of you know, let's try a special effect on this, and let's try a bit of slap echo on that, and let's try feeding this through another studio and picking it up at the other end of a wall on a speaker with carpets over it and all that sort of stuff, you know. And then, you know, engineers started to become, you know, important creative forces within the recording process.
Hooking up young Parsons with the struggling veteran writer Eric Wolfson turned out to be the perfect pairing of Wolfson's conceptual writing with Parsons' technical ability and vast musical resources with London's finest musicians. Alan Parsons had just started producing on his own and had two early successes, but little payoff to show for it. So he approached Eric Wolfson for advice.
Eric was working in another studio in Abbey Road with a child star. I knew that he was an expert on the record business, so I went to him for some business advice, because there I was with two hits under my belt, not much to show for it financially. So he helped me, you know, get a proper production contract with EMI Records, with whom I was doing most of my work. The business arrangement that I had with Eric developed rapidly into a creative partnership, because although I knew Eric was a songwriter, I didn't really think that I was going to be recording his songs. But in almost no time at all, he'd got interest from 20th Century Records as a result of a meeting with the president at the MIDEM Festival in Cannes. And he managed to secure us a substantial amount of money to make our first album, Tales of Mystery and Imagination, on the strength purely of our reputations.
Like 1975's Tales of Mystery and Imagination, the follow-up iRobot in June 1977 didn't give us much information about who or what this Alan Parsons project was exactly, except the fact that there was a lot of musicians and singers involved. I asked Alan Parsons how difficult it was for the record company to promote and market an album by an act that could not tour, couldn't make TV appearances, or even have a picture taken.
There has been and will always be a problem, that, as far as the public's concerned, of, you know, in perceiving what my role is as an artist. The explanation that I tend to make, you know, when this confusion arises, is that it's a bit like being a film director. I mean, Steven Spielberg doesn't appear in his movies, but he is totally responsible for the way they turn out, and that's essentially what I do on my records. I control their input and their output and their final destiny in a way, without necessarily actually appearing on them.
iRobot launched a major hit in 1977, around a voice that Alan Parsons would come to use successfully on subsequent projects over the years.
It's a guy called Lenny Zakatek. It's actually this guy who sang Wouldn't Want to Be Like You on iRobot. Lenny is an Anglo-Indian descendant. He's sort of brown skin, not exactly black and not exactly white. He looks more sort of Indian, but He grew up in a well-to-do family and speaks totally without accent. Speaks very good English. He actually comes from the same line of descent as our very own Cliff Richard. You know, who's a big star in the UK. And Freddie Mercury. I think he was also Anglo-Indian. So there's a few of them out there. And you know, he kept appearing and reappearing on various songs throughout the life of the Alan Parsons Project. And I'm still in touch with him to this day.
Next, Alan Parsons shares the album's thought-provoking concept. I'm Red Beard, and you're in the studio for the breakthrough 1977 multi-million seller from the Alan Parsons Project called iRobot.
Hello, this is Alan Parsons in the studio for the making of iRobot.
And I'm Red Beard. Parsons and his creative partner, Eric Wolfson, had based the first Alan Parsons Project around the literary works of Edgar Allan Poe. For their 1977 follow-up, they chose science fiction writer Isaac Asimov's novel, I, Robot. Here's Alan Parsons with me in the studio.
It was basically to take the title of Isaac Asimov's and then totally to reverse the philosophy that Asimov came up with in his book. I mean, Asimov implied that robotic creatures would have been designed to be totally safe and would never be able to harm human beings. Our philosophy was that's not at all what will happen. I mean, we're already approaching the age where machines are more intelligent than we are, and I think there is a real danger that if we invent thinking machines, then they might ultimately destroy us. Thank you.
Written about artificial intelligence and a warning about relinquishing too much human decision-making to computers, that's the Alan Parsons Project from iRobot with The Voice.
Despite having this reputation as being, having electronica roots, I always preferred to use real strings or real brass or real woodwind rather than use any kind of synthesized sound. And you have to realize that, I mean, in 76, 77, 78, those were still the early days for synthesizers, and so especially polyphonic synthesizers. By the time Eve came along, there was a big monster Yamaha polyphonic synthesizer called the CX-80, which you could play chords on, but you had to tune it almost every day to get it to sound anything like in tune. It was an absolute nightmare of an instrument, but it had some great sounds. In fact, there are a few examples of it on iRobot.
There's another song about artificial intelligence, albeit from the robot's point of view, called Breakdown, featuring the unmistakable voice of Alan Clark of the Hollies.
I'd been working with the Hollies for some years as their engineer. They were always in Abbey Road, always coming in to do stuff. And I just approached him and says, "Alan, will you sing a song for me?" And he said he absolutely loved every second of it. He found it really interesting to be working on somebody else's record. He'd never worked on anything other than his own material with the Hollies and possibly one solo venture of his own. The fact that that Alan Clark did that sort of paved the way for a whole bunch of other artists to work on my records. And the attitude is tremendous because they don't feel that their career is at stake by doing this by doing an album with me. You know, I'm not trying to steer their career in any particular direction that they wouldn't want. So it's a nice double benefit there.
I hate
Breakdown, featuring the distinctive voice of Holly's lead singer Alan Clark from the album iRobot. Even though polyphonic synthesizers and digital technology were still in the future, Alan Parsons did try some innovative things in 1977 when recording the album iRobot.
One thing we did have, which was interesting, was we actually designed a keyboard, which we referred to as the Projectron. It was an early predecessor to the Fairlight, because it involved taking real recordings and making them into loops and transferring them to a keyboard. The only difference was that rather than having a digital storage medium, which the keyboard was controlling, it was controlling a tape machine. So you would literally play a 24-track tape full of a chromatic scale of a particular sound, a voice, or some sort of plucked instrument or whatever. Each note of the tape machine would be plugged into the key of a keyboard. And so we were able to get an early version of what has become a sort of standard sound now, the ooh and ah sort of vocal loop sound that is always being used on records these days, and we were perhaps one of the first people to do that.
The lovely Languid Day After Day from the Alan Parsons Project and iRobot. When we return, Alan looks back on this 1977 album that was a turning point for a series of international million sellers that would follow. I'm Redbeard with Alan Parsons in the studio for iRobot.
Hello, this is Alan Parsons in the studio for the making of iRobot.
And I'm Redbeard. Welcome back. No less than 7 lead vocalists appear on iRobot, but often on a project, Alan Parsons would have 2 different singers have a go at the same song, and then they'd choose one for the album. But in the case of the song Some Other Time on iRobot, Parsons and his partner Eric Wolfson couldn't choose between the 2 singers. Trouble was, one was a man and one was a woman. Here's Alan Parsons in the studio.
This is one of the occasions where we got 2 singers in to sing the song, and we decided to divide the song into 2 parts, you know, and make it a 2-part thing. One of the singers was a lady called Jackie Wittron, who had a sort of one-off hit with a song called, I think it's called Please Give Me the Day or something, I think the song's called. The other singer was a guy who'd been starring in the Hair show some years previous. Peter Straker. Their voices are actually so similar that it does almost sound like one. Yeah, the choruses are sung by Jackie and the verses are sung by him.
In a matter of a moment lost till the end of time, it's the evening of another day and the end of mine. Starlight, which has found me lost for a million years, tries to linger as it fills my eyes till it disappears. Would it be that somebody else?
fabulous song, and yes, sung by a man on the verses, and believe it or not, a woman on the choruses. That's Some Other Time from iRobot by the Alan Parsons Project.
I must give credit to Eric Wolfson for doing the bulk of the songwriting. Although I did have a hand in this one, it has to be said, but I was no lyric writer, especially in those days, as did he on most of the projects. When I met him, he was in a rather difficult period, trying to make it as a producer, and I bumped into him at Abbey Road, and he was producing a young kid, a 10-year-old boy who was the son of a bigwig EMI executive at the time. You know, I gave Eric his big break, and he gave me mine. You know, there's no question that it was a partnership that worked. Obviously, it happened for a reason, because as soon as we worked together, we created a certain amount of magic and a certain amount of notoriety, if you like.
Alan Parsons told me that he attended the same London private school with Andrew Lloyd Webber. Maybe that's why one of the songs on iRobot, called Don't Let It Show, always reminded me of something from a West End musical or a Broadway show.
I'd always felt that Eric leant towards the kind of material that might get incorporated into a musical, and I was ultimately proved right, because the thing we did together in early 90s was, became a musical. There was something in a lot of his songs which suggested theatrical environments, and Don't Let It Show is very much I think a stage song, and I knew very much that we needed a real voice to sing it.
If it's getting harder to face every day, don't let it show. Don't let it show. Though it's getting harder to take what they say, just let it go. Just let it go. And if it hurts when they mention my name, say you don't know me. And if it helps when they say I'm to blame, say you don't know me. It's taking the easy way out. Keep it inside of you. Don't give in. Don't tell them anything. Don't let it. To believe there's a way, I won't be there. I won't be there. But if you smile when they mention my name, they'll never know you. And if you laugh when they say I'm to blame, they'll never own you. We'll be right back.
This is Redbeard in the Studio, thanking Alan Parson. In the Studio was written this edition by yours truly, Redbeard, transcription by Jane Carpenter, theme song by Andy Timmons. Produced by Barbarossa Limited, copyright 2008, all rights reserved. Be a part of the In the Studio Network at inthestudio.net.